I'm here with Gord Hill, and shortly Peter Gelderloos will be joining us. Gord Hill is a longtime organizer for Indigenous sovereignty and is a Vancouver-based writer and illustrator who's launching a new book called The 500 Years of Resistance comic book, where he blends his visual and literary talents to tell a thoroughly researched story of Aboriginal life since the arrival of Europeans in the Western Hemisphere in 1492. And if the book's title isn't enough to tell you what perspective Gord, a member of the Kwakwaka Yawak Nation, is taking, this interview will. Peter Gelderloos is also a radical community organizer. He is also an author and is the author of several powerful books, including How Nonviolence Protects the State and the newly published Anarchy Works. Peter's well-argued books are sure to convince people that the doctrine of nonviolence is misinformed, racist, patriarchal, authoritarian, and ineffective. Peter's books certainly do a remarkable job in arguing that privileged people who are not prepared to participate in strategic violent resistance directly should at least ally with those who are, rather than isolating them. Hi, Gord.
Hello.
What do you mean by 500 years of resistance? There's these two publications that you've worked on. One's titled 500 Years of Resistance, and the second one is the comic book form titled 500 Years of Resistance, the comic book. What do you mean by 500 Years of Resistance?
Well, it's 500 years of Indigenous resistance to European colonization, beginning with the voyage of Christopher Columbus in 1492 into the Caribbean region, and then the subsequent invasion by different European powers at the time, and throughout South, Central, and North America, and how different Indigenous nations struggled to survive and to maintain their territories and to defend their peoples and culture, way of life. So that's what both those books are about. And one of them is a text version, and the other one is a comic book version, which is kind of meant to be more accessible to young people and to people who just have a harder time reading, studying, whatnot.
That's great. That's a great idea. And so, Peter, how does nonviolence protect the state?
Nonviolence protects the state in a number of ways. Above all, it creates this idea that it's legitimate to censor people's participation in social struggles, and it creates this model of a social struggle that is going to be more homogenous in its tactics. It creates an equivalence between the violence of resistance and the violence of struggle with the violence of coercion and domination, just because of this linguistic coincidence that these very different things are described with the same word. Violence is not at all a precise category, so fighting back against police or reclaiming land or sabotaging the machinery of the economy is not at all similar to torture, to carpet bombings, to setting up prisons and solitary confinement units, to machine gunning crowds. These are the type of things that governments do, and it's not at all similar to what people do when they're struggling for their freedom.
Defending themselves.
Exactly. So nonviolence takes the focus away from the things that we're struggling against and puts them on our own actions and creates this scare effect that in some ways excuses the things that the government does, which are often kind of more invisible forms of violence, and makes us back away from different tactics of struggle.
You talk about your book, about the illusion of democracy inherently robbing working class people or the non-ruling people of power. How does that happen?
Well, democracy doesn't really change the structure of society that the wealth of society is owned and controlled by a very small number of people, but it does create the illusion of participation, that everyone is basically tricked to participate in their own exploitation and to sort of rubber stamp their own exploitation by taking part in these various rituals that legitimize the ruling power structures without really challenging their existence. So when you vote, you can vote on who leads you or what policies are going to govern this ongoing exploitation and colonization, this ongoing rule and domination, but it never comes up for a vote. the fundamental way in which society is structured, the fundamental rules of ownership and control. In fact, specifically as it relates to indigenous land sovereignty or to colonization, Supreme Court justices in the U.S. explicitly ruled that the courts of the colonizer can't undo the conquest on which their government was founded. They explicitly said that even if in the first instance, this robbing of land might not have seemed, legal according to the legal principles by which the society was said to operate, that it couldn't undo those crimes. It couldn't undo that stealing of land because that formed the very basis of the political system. So basically, democracies are unable to challenge the forms of oppression on which they're founded.
And so what would challenge that? You can talk about decentralization and the importance of these kind of systems and how that would make us stronger. You're talking in your book about it creating a more of a creative, collective, intelligent, uncontrolled resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, first of all, that's why we talk about revolution, because there's no way to change the system in bits and pieces. It really needs to be destroyed. It's completely antithetical to any free society, so it can't simply transition to that. But the institutions that currently shape and distribute power really need to be destroyed, because they won't allow a fundamental redistribution of power or even what power means. And what we need instead is societies that are decentralized, society in which power is located in the people and in the communities who create it, who create everything that we need to live off of, that people are basically the ones who are in control of their own lives and in deciding and creating the relationships that they need in order to survive, because no one exists alone, which is precisely why this statist vision of anarchy or of society without the state is so false, because the state tells us that, without it, everyone would be going around attacking one another as though they were these completely disconnected individuals. But in fact, people survive through their relationships with one another, and that's how they would gain the ability to organize their lives without laws, without direction, without control, and also without punishment, but with consequences, with very real consequences for their action, which teach them about their place in the world, because any time they do something that hurts someone else, then people respond to that, then they get consequences for their actions. So they learn, actually in a very mature and deep way, about the impact that they have on the rest of the world and about their relationships with the rest of the world.
How is freedom of speech a scam?
Freedom of speech? Yeah. Well, you have the right to say whatever you want, as long as you don't ever do anything. You don't ever do anything about what you're talking about and that. And, but even then, my most recent experience with the anti-Olympic thing is we don't have a right to free speech. You say things, it has consequences, even if you don't do anything about what you're talking about. Because we had, people who were outspoken during the anti-Olympic movement, they were the ones who were being harassed and put under surveillance by the police and stopped and detained and arrested at times and whatnot. So even this idea that people have a right to freedom of speech, it's false. And it does play into the idea, it feeds into the illusion of this democratic system, democratic state, where citizens have all kinds of rights and freedoms, because it's all controlled. And if you have a right, if someone has given you a right, then they can take it away. And that is what they will do whenever they deem it necessary or appropriate to impose their will.
Mm-hmm. And so, Gord, how would the quality of life of and the quality of our minds and our state of personal relationships, community, the way we think, how would it be more livable and healthy if we all, or more of us at least, were into being more of a culture of resistance? In a talk that both you and Peter had done together recently that I had attended, Peter talked about communities of people with common struggles, not being homogenous. So the goal for everyone to be unified by their common struggles and by a common goal, let's say, to protect the well-being of all living beings, so people, animals, ecosystems, plants, etc., over helping prop up the privileges, the abilities for negligent, greedy, bully-like economists to have power over us and all other living beings is definitely a long-term thing. Talk about an example of that.
Well, I think if you look at indigenous tribal societies, generally, that is the situation you had, where people are living in the same village, their families are growing up together, they know one another, they have respect and a similar experience, trust within their communities and families, and everybody in the community is going to be held accountable. Whereas today, if you look at indigenous communities, such as on the reservations and that, the so-called leadership are not accountable to the people. They don't even need the people. They get everything they require from the government. Their paychecks, their offices, the infrastructure, the band council gets it all from the government. They don't need the people, therefore they don't need to be accountable to the people. But in historically, traditionally, these people would be held accountable to the people, and they really did. You know, in the best cases, they served the people. The people who had positions of leadership, I mean, they were recognized as being a good leader if they, the less that they had, the more that they gave, the more that they distributed to the community. So, I don't know if that answers your question.
I think that's good. Why is it essential that the sense of urgency is part of a culture of resistance?
I think it's necessary to realize that this is an urgent situation that we face, and it's a serious issue, because specifically we can't just engage in these polite discussions. We can't just all sit down at the table and talk about these problems, because we're not going to enter into a dialogue with our enemies, with the people whose entire position in society comes from exploiting us and dispossessing us and controlling us, because to dialogue with them is to ensure their continued existence, is to give them legitimacy. In the world that I want to live in, those kind of authority figures don't exist. So there's absolutely nothing to gain from talking with them. It's not a matter of just opinions about, you know, which way society is headed or various social issues, but a much more serious situation, that basically capitalism and the state constitute a war against all of us. And when you recognize that that's the reality of the situation, then you have to take your actions and your position much more seriously. And we shouldn't be urgent in the sense of being impatient or being desperate, because it's going to be a very long-term struggle, and it has been a long-term struggle. And if we enter into that in a desperate way, then we're much more likely to have our hopes crushed. But if we understand that it's at the same time a very serious struggle and also a very long-term struggle that needs to go to the roots of the way this society is organized, then we have a better chance of enduring for the long haul.
Why will the state never win? Oh, God, sorry.
Well, the state will never win because it's on a course of self-destruction, and that ties into the question of urgency. It's like we're facing an ecological crisis, a global ecological crisis, global economic crisis, increasing militarization, social conflict. This is the urgency. This is why we must act. If we do not act, we will be vulnerable to the declining social conditions that we are entering into. And this is what history teaches us. And this is why we must organize resistance movements and networks so that we're able to exploit these declining socioeconomic, environmental conditions that we're entering into, and as a method of survival. And this is also what we can learn, you know, people can learn from indigenous peoples. If you do not have a will to resist, to fight, that is the number one thing you need in order to survive. That's why urgency is important now. That's why the state will never win, because it's a self-destructive entity. And yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and they're not really the committers of helpful thinking or deep thinking.
Well, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.